Before we get started, I wanted to give a shout out to Jeannie Colwin Coaching. Jeannie Colwin is a stress and mind body coach in Los Angeles, and you might remember that she guest hosted the podcast back in January and then actually came on live with me back in August of 2021. Jeannie facilitates breath work to decrease stress, release stuck negative emotions, and decrease pain. Are you having trouble calming the monkey mind? Well, she's your gal. It's not about controlling or managing your stress or your thoughts. Instead, it's about shifting and improving the relationship that you have with them. Jeannie spent over 16 years battling fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and a myriad of other chronic symptoms that left her physically and mentally exhausted. She healed herself completely, and now she's obsessed with getting her clients fast results through her one-on-one coaching program. If you're interested in learning more about working with her one-on-one, you can reach out to her via her website, which is www.jeanniecolwin.com. That's JeannieKulwin.com. She even offers a free 30-minute consult so you can get more info and learn about her exciting program directly. And if you'd like to receive instant access to her recorded breathwork mini session, just visit her website again. That's JeannieKulwin.com to sign up. And if you want to learn more, check out the show notes, and it's got the appropriate links for her on social as well as her website. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein, and it is Wednesday, April the 27th, 2022. And I want to give a shout out to the newest patron on the podcast. Go to patreon.com/ the Mind and Fitness Podcast. Patricia, welcome and thank you. Emily, Brent, and Paul also all joined this month. So welcome to all of you here in April. And then Amanda, Elise, Enda, Dominic, Sasha, Sylvie, James, John, Jason, Mindy, Irina, Kelly, Tony, Michael, Anthony, Christina, Ross, Julie, Brian, Arnie, and Barb. Thank you all so much for continuing to support the podcast. Certainly would not be possible without all of you. So I got a great interview today. Now, Christy Weepy has been, she's been on the podcast several times. She is the executive director of the Better Mind Center. And I reached out to her many, many months ago and had asked, hey, I'd love to be connected with one of your therapists to do an interview. So that's what today is. So Mary Claire Dossa-Guinness from Los Angeles is going to be on the line with me. She's going to talk a little bit about her methodology and kind of why she got into this particular line of work. I do want to give a little bit of a preface, and I've edited it as much as I can. There was a little bit of an audio issue just shy of 20 minutes in, so I cut out some of that. So it sounds a little bit different when you get to about the 18-minute mark. So just bear with us, and it is what it is. But without further ado, here is Mary Claire. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast, and I have a really great interview for you today. With me on the West Coast, which is the best coast, is Mary Claire Dossa-Guinness. Are you there? Can you hear me?
I'm here. You got it right.
Awesome. Terrific. Good. So you're in LA. I was ironically just there 2 weeks ago. Lovely. We did a few days at Disney and went to Newport Beach and all that stuff. So,
that's awesome.
I'm excited to dive in to conversation today. A lot of it around pain reprocessing therapy and kind of how you got into this and all that kind of stuff. But we'll start with the more boring stuff. Have you always lived in California? Is that where you originate, or did you come from somewhere else?
Yeah, I'm from the Pasadena area, actually. And I went to college in New York, in Poughkeepsie, New York.
Okay.
So I did a few years there and then came back to LA for graduate school.
Okay.
So primarily in LA.
I only know Poughkeepsie because I'm a pro wrestling aficionado, a geek, if you will. And, a lot of times when, performers are talking about, like when they give an example of like a hole in the wall city with a really small crowd, all of them inevitably say Poughkeepsie, New York. That's the only reason that I even have ever even heard that name before, that city before.
Yes, it's very small. It's great. It's got charm.
Okay, good, good.
Yeah.
So you and I got connected through Christy Weepy, who, if you've been listening to the show for any length of time, she's been on two or three times and actually was sort of the rescue therapist that came and taught. The day after COVID was declared a pandemic, the first person I called was Christy, and I asked if she could come on and talk. And so her and I have had a really good relationship over the last couple of years. Now, you were formerly at the Pain Psychology Center. Is that right?
Yes, awesome. Absolutely. And that's where I met Christy, actually.
Awesome. Okay, so brain reprocessing therapy, really sort of the hallmark, especially right now in terms of people that listen to this podcast, people that are going through chronic pain or chronic anxiety or different things of that nature. Is this like, if we were to rewind, let's say 10 or 15 years ago, or maybe when you started going to school for anything, because maybe you, I don't know, maybe you started as a poli sci major, or maybe that was, you know, you wanted to go into video production or broadcasting or something like that. How long ago did this start for you? Like, I want to be a pain psychologist. Like, when did that begin?
Yeah. It started, when was this? I got my MSW at USC. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. And I started off working in community mental health. So I wasn't really doing anything related to this. I didn't know a lot about chronic pain. It wasn't something that was really taught in grad school. And it wasn't until I first took a training in ISTDP, intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy, that I was first introduced to the idea that emotions and anxiety could result in physical symptoms in the body. You know, and they would talk about case examples where people had severe stomach pain or headaches that were getting resolved by facing and feeling difficult emotions. And right away, it really resonated with me. I was very interested in that, but I still didn't work in the chronic pain world for, I think, maybe another year and a half until since that training.
So there was really just something where you went and you took this course and then your eyebrows went up and you were just sort of like, ah, this is extra interesting.
Exactly.
So, and this is something that I was very surprised about when I first started doing this show, which is, this is year five of doing the podcast, maybe even year six of doing this podcast. And I've interviewed lots of therapists around the world. I mean, probably, I'd guess, 40 or 50 maybe at this point. And something I was always surprised about, especially when I started seeing a therapist, and even the first one that I saw after I started looking at Dr. Sarno's work, is that that is not the norm among psychotherapists. And I thought it would be. I thought that all of them, you know, every therapist that you were to go and meet, that's the norm for them, that they do believe that chronic pain in a lot of ways either originates or certainly escalates in the mind, but that's not the norm. And you had said, remind me of the acronym again, because I always get the ISTDP. Is that right?
ISTDP.
Oh, yep. Perfect. Okay, got it on the first try.
You got it.
Give us a little bit more detail on that.
Gosh. So there's probably a lot of ways to describe it, but it's basically the treatment is focused on the experience and expressing of emotions to reduce suffering, right? And so basically there's this idea that emotions can feel so intolerable that they are unconsciously repressed. And different things like anxiety and defenses can kind of maintain that, right? That the emotions kind of keep getting sent away. And the treatment is really experiential. It's all about focused on regulating anxiety, recognizing defenses, and helping someone start to express and experience their emotions.
And and again, this is something where we're not in a session, and that's not necessarily the design, but I am very curious because my only exposure to it really was in reading Dr. Schubiner's book, where he's describing like doing this with a patient of his, and just reading it was very intense. Can you maybe give us an example of an instance where somebody comes in, they have some sort of a chronic ailment, you know, could be a knee or a hip or a back or whatever the case is. And you determine, okay, this is the right course of treatment for them. Like, what do you do then?
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes exploring a little bit more about what was going on at the time, when the symptoms does that resonate with anything that happened in the past? It sometimes give us a clue where to go. But yeah, there's kind of an exploratory process in the beginning of just kind of figuring out what is being kind of sent away here.
So is that usually like the primary course of treatment for you and people that, because there's, for all the books that are out there about chronic pain treatment, there's journaling there. I mean, somatic tracking is really my favorite, but there's journaling, talk therapy, there's a variety of different types. And so what, I guess, for what it is that you would prescribe to somebody that's coming in, what sort of mechanisms or what sort of things tip you off to say, okay, this is the right course of action for this person, meaning like doing ISTDP as an example.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if this is helpful to explain, but so usually I draw a diagram for people at the beginning, because I think everyone has a pretty unique pain tapestry, right? There's a lot of similarities, there's a lot of themes, but I basically draw these two prongs, right? Where there is the pain fear cycle itself, right? Imagining that feedback loop, pain fear. And obviously that alone is enough to maintain itself. But then I draw all these arrows coming in, right? Okay, then there's all these other things that can contribute to fear, right? Past traumas, the way that we relate to ourselves, right? Maybe we're really hard on ourselves. Maybe we see ourselves as a bad person, right? And we're attacking ourselves all the time. The stressors at the time that the pain started, or current stressors, personality traits, and all of those things can keep us in a state of high alert and can contribute to the pain fear cycle. And so I really like to assess with somebody, what do they think are some of their contributors to fear? And usually people have a pretty good idea. I'd say a lot of my clients can recognize, like, I had a lot of grief, right, when my pain started, or I felt a lot of anxiety. There was, a death and I felt a lot of anxiety, but I wasn't able to experience it at the time. Usually people are so insightful and are pretty aware of a lot of the factors that are contributing to their pain, and they kind of need the space and the tools to start to get in touch with those feelings, because usually for a variety of reasons, they've learned that those feelings are not okay, right? Whether it was explicitly told to them, being angry is wrong and bad, or it makes you a bad person. And so there's elements of ISTDP that are actually quite similar to somatic tracking in a lot of ways, right? It is about like feeling the physical sensation of the motion in the body, being curious with it, not sending it away. But so that's a little bit about how I do that assessment.
So help smarten me up or chat me up on this thing. Cause this is something that I've always thought about is, cause I would say for me, the biggest tool in my toolkit is doing somatic bit, like mindfulness based somatic approach. Like that's kind of just my, and a lot of times, like I'll give you an example is that, we put my 13-year-old dog down about a week and a half ago or a week ago or so. It was very tough in the weeks leading up to that. Began having pains that were not familiar, like mid back, hip stuff in the leg, like things that aren't, they're not commonplace for me. And a few weeks went by, and I did go and seek a physical therapist because I wanted to make sure that a couple of years ago I had a crash on a skateboard and I really messed up my ankle pretty bad. And I did journaling. I did somatic work. Pain went away. Function was not correct though. Something just felt like it was very much off. So I went and found a physical therapist then. And I had dislocated my fibula. So she glided my fibula back in place. We taped it up. I was as good as gold when I left the office. So that was an example of like, there was something mechanical that needed to happen, but the pain I was able to lessen with somatic work and just healing in general. So, yeah. But that's one thing that I'm always kind of challenged with is like, if I have a symptom in the body, let's say my hip as an example, and I sit there and kind of somatically zero in on my hip, I might not feel any feelings come up versus, maybe if I'm not feeling any pain at all. But a lot of times before bed, part of my like mindfulness or meditation practice, whatever you want to call it, is really thinking about, I basically just kind of zero in and focus on my sternum. And I just kind of sit there with it. And then I start really feeling almost like a anxiety attack coming on. Like lots of just swirling and heaviness. And, it's very difficult to describe, but, I really start feeling, emotions coming then. Again, there's no pain anywhere in my body, and it's not focused on a painful part of my body. And it's something that wasn't there before. So when you're working with people, do you tend to have them do somatic work based on the area of pain or somatic work based on something else? I guess, how do you best explain that? And if that wasn't clear at all, please tell me.
Yeah. I think I look at them as kind of two separate things.
Okay.
Right. Obviously, sometimes when we're focusing on an emotion, the pain turns up. But I think usually I have people focus elsewhere. So one way I understand it is emotions have three components. There's the cognitive label, I'm sad, right? There's the physical pathway in the body. Where do I feel that sadness? And often it's a heaviness in the chest, you know, like the softening in the face and, you know, tearing in the eyes, sometimes a tightening in the throat. And then what's the impulse that goes with that feeling? So there's those three components. And so, often emotions are found in like the torso area, sometimes in the arms, sometimes in the legs. But I think kind of, moving into the trunk area, usually there's a lot of sensation there that people start to experience.
And then how is that tied in, I guess, to, you know, again, like I'm just trying to think of places that are distant from the trunk. If we say an ankle or we say a foot or we say a knee, is your approach still work somatically in the trunk or is it work somatically in the knee? Or I guess how would you define that or talk about that?
I guess it depends on what we're doing, right? Because so just the way, there is like a titration process, right? Mm-hmm. You want to slowly increase how much of the pain sensation can I tolerate, right? How long can I sit with this discomfort in my knee, knowing that it's safe, knowing that it's okay for it to be there before I get too scared, right? Before my fear starts to go up or the sensation gets too high, right? So, you know, we would do that kind of graded exposure work of let me move towards it, let me move when we're doing somatic tracking in the knee. And there can be a really similar process with emotions, right? There's sometimes just like a smaller dosage that someone can experience, right? So it might be, I'm feeling sadness in my chest and it starts to feel overwhelming really fast. And then, you know, then we might focus somewhere else, right? Maybe we might do a grounding practice. We might come to a neutral sensation in the body. Because we are also starting to reduce avoidance around emotions, right? Just the way we want to reduce avoidance around pain, because that avoidance, the pain fear cycle alive, we want to reduce the avoidance around emotions.
Yeah.
Because that also kind of keeps us stuck in suffering. But it's okay if we can only handle a small amount at a time. It's okay to listen to that. Does that make sense?
It does. And how, like in instances like that, if somebody's coming to you, I mean, the result in how you treat it may be exactly the same, but if somebody is coming to you with, Mary Claire, I'm feeling very depressed, or Mary Claire, I feel very anxious, or Mary Claire, I have this back pain that's been killing me for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, is treatment approach pretty much the same? Like the outcome is probably going to be the same, but is the way to which you go about it, somebody that experiences symptoms as their emotions versus somebody that experiences depression or anxiety, like, do you kind of look at those as interchangeable, or is there some kind of a treatment method maybe that's different?
There's a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
There's a lot of similarities in the treatment of anxiety and the treatment of pain. And I mean, I think sometimes I think chronic pain is an anxiety disorder, right? It's a very similar process that maintains it. You know, the avoidance maintains it. Those nervous system states of fight or flight keep going. And some people look at depression and anxiety as kind of two sides of the same coin. But I would start with an assessment of when did this start? You know, what was going on at the time? Was there conflict? Was there loss? Was there, you know, something that disrupted this person's relationship with safety? And I find often there is something like that in all of those cases. And then, you know, that pain, fear, or anxiety, fear cycle got started. So it can be pretty similar.
I think that, okay, that sentence was really good. And I tried to type it as you said it, and I don't know if I got it totally right. Cause I want to open that up a little bit.
Sure.
What happened that disrupted this person's perception of safety? It was something like that. So immediately the things that come to mind when I think of that is like a kid witnessing their, you know, maybe their mom being hit by their dad, like kind of major, you know, major capital T traumas. But I mean, I get emails and messages from people all over the world all the time that have kind of been stuck in this chronic pain cycle for so long, months or years or even decades in some case. They say that there wasn't anything, they say there's basically nothing big that they can point to that's happened in their life that they can say this was a big trauma. So what are some other examples of like maybe things that are listening to this that are kind of on the peripheral of disrupting a person's perception of safety that can also occur? Stuff that's not the big, I was in a car accident, I was shot, I was assaulted, like things like that. What are some other ones that are maybe, we don't want to minimize them, but things that maybe have occurred that you've heard of or come in contact with that still fit that bill?
Yeah. And I think that's why I like that definition of trauma as anything that impacts your relationship with safety, because that really does encapsulate maybe some of the little T and the big T traumas. I guess a little T trauma could be the loss of a pet, the loss of a relationship. One instance of bullying, right? If it wasn't, obviously bullying can be a big T trauma. But it's really like anything that is distressing, right? And overwhelms our ability to cope.
Yeah.
So a lot of things can fall. And I think a lot of little things can add up, right? Even if it's just kind of little criticisms by a parent. A parent being really anxious all the time. Struggling to express their own emotions, right? And not making space for yours, right? Sometimes those can be big T traumas, but sometimes those can be little T.
And it, with it, and I hate to try and quantify this, but is it like, I think of it as like a bank exchange. Like you have 10 $1 bills or you have one $10 bill. Is like, I mean, is it in therapy, it sounds so weird to say, does it, in therapy, does it work like, you can have 10 little T traumas or you can have one big T trauma. And does it work like that at all? Or is that totally off? Okay.
And often there's a combination.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel weird to ask my therapist or ask, you know, a higher being or something, hey, can I get change for a big T trauma? So that's funny. One thing that I'm also kind of curious about, because I've got two young children, they're 7 and 4, both girls, and one thing that I wonder, so we had our dog that passed away, and my 7-year-old seemed to be in perfectly good health. She cried her eyes out, she talks about him all the time, all that kind of stuff. They're best friends. She met him when she was born, obviously. But then she stayed home sick from school on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday last week. And it did sound like she had a bug. And part of my thought process behind that was, you know, that was, it's a big emotion for her because it's like, aside from the people that live in this house, it's the only people that she's known since birth, really. And so, you know, maybe weakened her immune system. So she caught something she otherwise would not have caught. Like, that's kind of what kept coming into my mind. Like, do you work with younger kids or how, I guess, like, what's maybe the younger age? Because I know there's the ACE study and there's things like that. But one thing I'm curious about is how long it takes for symptoms to start manifesting themselves in kids. I guess, like, what are some of the younger ages where you start to see or you have heard, you know, stories or that there's any sort of data around kids as young as 7 or kids as young as 10, you know, they start to experience mind-body symptoms?
Gosh, I used to work with kids, but it's been probably at least 5 years since I've worked with a young kid. But I mean, a lot of my clients report to me getting headaches, when they were seven, right? Getting a lot of stomach issues when they were really young. And so I think that's actually a really common kind of early manifestation.
No, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Right now, like, I guess maybe because how long have you been doing this?
I first started at the Pain Psychology Center, I think about 5 years ago.
Okay.
2017.
So one thing I always love to hear about, Christy gave me a great story when I had asked her, you know, what, without using names and ways to describe people and stuff like that, I'm always kind of like, what's sort of the most, like, you know, miraculous story of healing that you have of someone that you had worked with? She told this crazy story of somebody that had, like, their neck was in such disarray that they were turned almost 180 degrees behind. So she's like, a lot of times we would have these sessions and either she'd see the back of their head or she'd see their back in order to see their face. And, you know, they'd work together for quite some time. And then slowly you would start to see this head turning back and a lot of that tension go away. Like, are there any stories that are like that, or someone that maybe didn't think that they'd get better because it seemed like it was like it would have been so tough to overcome, but they did overcome?
It's honestly insane how the mind goes blank when you're just like,
and it's really on the spot.
Honestly, this might just sound so cheesy, but I think it's all miraculous.
Yeah.
It all makes me so excited because, you know, symptoms cause so much suffering and so much distress. And I think everybody doubts to some degree that they're going to be able to get better. So I feel like it's all miraculous and it's such a pleasure to witness.
And how do you, because I'm imagining, like, for the most part, if not entirely, the people that come to you or are referred to you, these are people that, I mean, for the most part, when you get a new client, is it somebody that believes in mind body stuff? Because there is a big disconnect. I have people that believe in that 100% and there is no Western medical model for them. And then other people that are like, absolutely not. They'll just diminish mind body work. And it's entirely like whatever is on a medical image is like, that's the capital T truth. As far as the way the universe works, like by the time that people get to you, I would imagine that there are people that are versed in this stuff already, or am I wrong about that?
More often, almost 100% of the time, people, you know, they're seeking out this type of treatment because they're pretty sure this is exactly what's going on for me. They've usually read several books on TMS. They've seen the Boulder back pain study. They saw, you know, some of the more recent articles that were coming out. They are very knowledgeable on the subject and don't need a lot of education.
And what do you tend to, I mean, they're knowledgeable on it, but they're still struggling in some way. Yeah. Are there a couple of themes that, you know, these instances or these people when they come to you and they're like, I've read the books, I know the study, I believe it, but I'm not getting any results, or I've been stuck, you know, maybe I feel like I've gotten 25% better, but I'm still in pain much of the day, every day. Are there a couple of themes that you see or have identified where this is kind of maybe what's been holding them back from getting better?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a big one that I see is putting pressure on the timeline, right? Why am I not better yet? How long is this going to take? Why does this take longer for me than for other people? The uncertainty is so scary, right? It's so uncomfortable to not know how long this is going to take. But trying to control something uncontrollable only makes our fear worse, right? And it feels like worrying about the timeline and trying to deal with the uncertainty this way will make us feel safer, but it doesn't, right? Trying to control things keeps the system in a state of fight or flight.
Yeah, for sure. So that brings up a good point is that, you know, somebody has an issue that's been going on for weeks or months or whatever the case is, and they have, you know, maybe they admit to you, Mary Claire, I have been looking at the clock and I expect it to be better by now. I mean, do you find that like once they can literally just let go of that timeline that they start to rapidly get better?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the time there's a big increase in just success, right? And I think the other thing is people don't give credit to the successes that they've already had and the progress that they've made, right? Usually they are better than they were. Usually they've done so much work to start to change their relationship with their pain and change the pain beliefs that they had. Or they aren't being fair to themselves about how long they've been in a state of fear or believing that there was something really wrong with them.
So one thing I'm always curious about for people that have been doing this for a few years, is that the timeline works out almost perfect. So you had said you started at the Pain Psychology Center about 5 years ago. So, I mean, 5 years ago at this time, 5 years ago, I was still kind of in the throes of seeing a new physical therapist every week, a new chiropractor every week, a new doctor every week, that nobody could seem to figure, you know, I would get these images and they would say, it's this, it's that. But I did not meet anybody during that time that had alluded or even implied that there could be anything mind-body related at all. It was all physical. And then when I went for that ankle issue a couple of years ago, the PT had prescribed the taping of the ankle probably for a couple more weeks, and then meditation, which was really interesting. I was doing this podcast at that time. I was very aware of all mind-body stuff, but it was the first time that I could remember any sort of a physical medicine practitioner alluding to anything that wasn't a physical treatment being the solution. And then, I'd said earlier, you know, this death of my dog and things like that, and having kind of these weird new sensations back and leg and hip and all that kind of stuff, and went and saw a physical therapist to rule out, hey, is there anything mechanical that I'm not, cause function, like pain isn't necessarily there, but sensations and function are, a bit of an issue. And she's asking me questions. We're doing strength tests and all this kind of stuff. And then she had started to kind of float in the idea. I don't know if she didn't know how he was going to take it. The problem with seeing anybody with a mask on right now is that you can't really tell what it is. You're poker facing everybody. Nobody can see emotions in your face when you're wearing a mask. So I had a mask on, and she had said, well, what else is going on in your life? Is there any recent stress or changes in lifestyle or anything going on at home or anything? And I was like, whew, like this is a little... And then she had prescribed me a couple of things more mechanical to help with training. But then journaling and mindfulness was the other thing. And so has this paradigm changed a lot in the 5 years you've been doing it? Or have I just gotten lucky the last two times that I've went to see somebody?
Honestly, I mean, I've heard of a few gems, right? I have some clients who have an awesome PT who is introducing some of these concepts to them and, you know, helping them help like have movement start to feel safer. And but I feel like in general, I'm still hearing a lot of the same, unfortunately. But yeah, there are a couple gems who I feel like are embracing this new way of thinking.
So you had mentioned the Boulder back pain study earlier, and I had interviewed a couple of people a few years back that was in its infancy. Were you involved with that, or were there any other studies that maybe you've been involved in at all, that you're at liberty to talk about?
I was not involved in that study, but I was involved in, they did, a study in Nevada, in Las Vegas, and Christy and Dr. Schubiner were both a part of that, where we went into a pain clinic and started to offer some of the folks there pain reprocessing therapy. And so those people had no idea what they were in for or what they were being offered. So that was a really different experience to the type of people that I usually work with, right, who are seeking this type of treatment out.
Yeah. And how would you differentiate, you know, the typical, like if I were to go on my insurance's website to try and find a therapist to work with, it'll give me categories. Do you want cognitive behavioral therapy? Do you want substance abuse therapy? Pain reprocessing therapy is not on the docket, at least right now, not for my provider anyway. Differentiate the two. What traditional CBT that most people that are listening to this that have ever worked with a therapist is probably what they got. Talk about the differences between the two.
Between CBT and PRT?
Yep.
Well, there's definitely elements of CBT in PRT. But PRT involves a lot more exposure than is just a part of CBT, right? It involves exposure to the sensation of pain, reappraisal of the sensation of pain. But yeah, there's elements of CBT in terms of understanding what are someone's current pain beliefs. You know, after we do some evidence gathering and rule in, yes, you have neural circuit pain, how do we start to reframe some of those beliefs? How do we start to respond differently to what's happening? But yeah, I think the experiential piece of somatic tracking and graded exposure is what makes it a little bit different than just traditional CBT.
And in your personal, you know, because therapists still hurt, I'm sure at some point you probably have some kind of physical issues maybe that happen at one point or another. Mm-hmm. What is like your personal toolkit look like? Like for yourself, I mean, maybe you go and see a therapist, maybe you don't. What if you know, you're trying to help yourself, what are a couple of the go-tos for you?
Yeah. Well, I did have a symptom before I knew what TMS was. Therapy was definitely part of that toolkit. Mm-hmm. I think it's so helpful to just have a safe place to experience and express your feelings. So yeah, that's definitely part of the toolkit. Mindfulness is a big part of the toolkit. Really like cultivating the stance of the observer, right? Can I just be with what is happening right now without trying to control or change it?
Yeah.
I think that's really helpful. Talking to myself, right? Like giving myself cognitive soothing is so important, right? You know, putting my hand on my chest and just saying, you are safe, you are okay right now. I was definitely doing that before we started talking today. Yeah, I think other physical things are really important. Like I do a lot of grounding. So really bringing yourself to the present moment, feeling your body, where you are right here, right now. Movement is really important for me. So I think yoga is sometimes a part of that. Walking outside is a part of that.
I totally agree. And actually that, the physical therapist I had mentioned recently that had said journaling and mindfulness, basically at the end of the appointment, one of the things that she said is that, you might've had a little tweak, but it's sort of irrelevant. And, she had just said that basically like my system thinks there's a threat, even though there's not a threat. So what needs to happen is that your system and all the musculature that's surrounding your hip, just needs to basically be given the message that there is no threat and that you're safe. And I just it's probably because I'm looking for it now. So yeah, that's probably why
that's
I'm seeing
awesome,
it so
though.
Often. But yeah, yeah. I thought it was just totally interesting because and even there's a pretty famous guy in the CrossFit and weightlifting world, which is sort of the world that I come from, named Kelly Starrett. And I used to follow his videos, you know, 10 years ago, and all of it was very physical based. And then about 2 years ago, he changed a lot of his branding. In fact, he used to call it Mobility Wad was the name of his company. And then recently he had changed in the last couple of years to what's called the Ready State, which seems like it's a very nuanced type of name. And I had just watched one of his videos recently, which was just titled, "What Do I Do If I Get a Back Tweak?" And it was just this long 7-minute video where he's saying, that your body thinks that it's under threat. So he's like, walking is what I would do first. And, he said maybe some breath work, but essentially we need to calm the system down and, let the system know there's not a threat. So I think that it is out there quite a bit more just in the last couple of years. But again, it could just be because I'm looking for it.
I mean, I'm hopeful it's going to catch on and become more and more ubiquitous.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you're seeing more of it. That's really hopeful.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Well, so if people are interested in working with you, how do they reach you, or how can they get in touch with you?
Mm-hmm. So I have a website, therapywithmaryclaire.com. And they can also reach me at Christie's group practice, the Better Mind Center. That's at bettermindcenter.com, I think.
Let me, mindcenter.com. Awesome. Yeah, all one word, the bettermindcenter.com. And then Therapy with Mary Claire, and it's spelled MARICLARE. Is that correct?
Yep. That's
awesome.
Correct.
Mary Claire, thanks so much for jumping on and talking through a little bit of this stuff with us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Okay, take care. Thanks, Mary Claire.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Okay, bye.